Welcome to the latest episode of Canda's Better Places podcast. I'm Cam Meads, Associate Director in our Strategic Communications team here at Canda Consulting. Today, we're delighted to be joined by someone who has been at the heart of London journalism for many years. He was at the Evening Standard for nearly 30 years and is the former business editor and associate editor. After a venture into the freelance world, he's about to join the Telegraph's business team as their retail editor. He has won and been nominated for multiple journalism awards, and his name has been synonymous with London's business media for a very long time. It's a privilege to welcome Jonathan Prynne to the podcast. Jonathan, welcome, and how are you?
Well, I'm very well. I'm feeling very good about myself after that introduction, Cam.
Good to hear it all laid out like that.
Yes. And your reputation precedes you, obviously, being in such a prominent role for so long. Really interested to know, you've had a bit of a time, as mentioned there, into the freelance world and a time to possibly sit back and reflect. And interested to know what your reflections are on your time at the Standard, being there for 30 years and obviously bit of a career before that as well, if you've had any time to pause and reflect, and what you've noticed about possibly the state of business media and how that has changed over the last 30 years.
Yeah, some very good questions there. I mean, first of all, I would say how incredibly lucky I've been to be covering and writing about London business and London consumer affairs and all the other things I've written about over the past 30 years almost of the Standard, and what the unceasingly interesting, fascinating, tumultuous city London is, both in the city and Canary Wharf and the financial services side of it, but also all the other industries, the tech, the life science, the hospitality scene, the arts and culture scene. You know, just what an incredible city it is. And I'm going to miss having that focus on London, although it's obviously going to be very interesting to write more nationally in future at the Telegraph, at a time when the government is obviously trying to focus the whole balance of the national economy slightly away from London. But yeah, I'd love writing about London. One of my reflections I think quite a lot about is how some of the drama has gone out of business journalism. I started in 1907 as a very raw rookie business reporter on a magazine, or actually a weekly newspaper called Corporate Money. I started in the summer or autumn, maybe, of 1907. Almost the very first story I got involved in was the crash of October 87. Which was an immensely dramatic, volatile period where, the FTSE was falling by, 10-15% a day at one stage. It was absolutely extraordinary time. And then the late 80s and 90s were a time of incredible swashbuckling, overs, leverage buyouts, mega mergers. You had these very charismatic business leaders. Some of them turned out to be absolute crooks. Some of them were very articulate captains of industry, the likes of which we don't see so much now. I think that's the one thing business journalism was slightly lost, is that it's that drama. It's a safer place now. Companies are safer. Chief executives are more guarded in what they say. There's less leadership in the business community than there used to be. Maybe there's fewer crooks. I think there almost certainly are. I think you need a few rogues on the scene just to make it interesting. Obviously, you don't want people to lose their hard-won investments. But it was a very dramatic time. Huge bankruptcies, companies going down. As I say, these amazing mergers. Who will ever forget the days of RBS and the build up to the financial crash of 07-08. It was an amazing ride. I've had I've had a very thrilling time. I do think we are living in a slightly quieter, cautious time for business journalism, but you know, there you go. I mean, everything has a cycle, right?
Yeah, I think it's a really, really interesting reflection, and you know, that's some. I agree. That's something that has probably been taken up the last 20 or so years, 10 years certainly, is I think risk aversion has gone up, possibly with all sorts of business leaders, and you know, rightly or wrongly, you know, of course that's to look after their share price and other things, but I suppose when you're thinking about, and a lot of these are our clients that are trying to sort of nozzle into the media and position their companies in a certain way, what do you think, what would your advice be to those companies to say something unique and different, but without scaring off the markets or their stakeholders?
My advice would be back yourself, have confidence. I mean, these people who run major companies, FTSE 100, FTSE 250, you know, they're not there without reason. They're obviously hugely talented people. They should back themselves to speak clearly and in a human voice. I think that's crucial. I think too many chief executives now get pulled down in jargon, acronyms, business acronyms, and unfortunately it just does not cut through to the general reader, to the consumer that maybe they're trying to invest or to address, or the lay investor. Maybe it works for the city audience, but I find it so frustrating the way in which so many business leaders go to their safe space when they're trying to communicate, and they just stay in that world of the business jargon, the acronyms, the financial jargon, financial ratios, all those things, which are also important, but it just doesn't cut through. It doesn't sound human. And I think that's one of the frustrations, as you say, more risk aversion going on. People are end up as a trap. They've got in their head. They should back themselves. They should think, yeah, they do have one of the reasons why I'm chief executive was business. I do have the ability. I'm articulate enough and I'm smart enough to pick a way that they understand. And I think that has been a real loss in the last 20 years. But the lack of chief executives who will sit around in a room with a load of journalists and talk in a way that business chain can relate to and understand. I think that's been the loss. I think one or two are brilliant at it still. Jamie Dimon at JP Morgan does a round table with journalists in London every year, and he's absolutely brilliant at communicating and is prepared to speak on almost any subject you want to raise. Simon Wilson in the same at Next, he's brilliant, communicates so well. Obviously has confidence in his own ability to talk without putting his foot in it. You know, we need more of those characters.
Correct. What's the benefit of doing that as a business leader? So you mentioned JP Morgan. What, because I suppose the hard thing to articulate sometimes to business leaders is what's the actual commercial benefit of putting your head above the parapet and saying something that is interesting? So what do you think, obviously, from your side, there's a benefit for you of getting the story and saying...
I think they need to step outside their very narrow world sometimes, or seeing it purely in terms of a sort of profit and loss account for their individual business, which is obviously that's what they're paid to do to make their business more profitable. But I think there's a broader picture as well, a broader societal picture. These people are huge employers. Their products and services are huge parts of our everyday lives, and more broadly, the private sector is the engine of the economy. Without the private sector firing on all cylinders, we don't have growth, and without growth, we know what happens: we don't get the tax revenues, the public finances are in a mess, we can't pay the public services that we need. And I do think since the financial crisis, we've Britain has operated in a fairly anti-private sector, anti-business environment. Even, I was a bit disappointed to hear Andy Burnham, one of his first statements was to say, after he delivered 20p off bus fares or whatever it was, he said, we're going to stop the supermarkets ripping people off. It felt like a cheap shot to me, and it felt, the supermarkets have been subjected to endless rounds of regulatory scrutiny. It's an intensely competitive market. Also, regulators and, need to keep an eye on what, I guess, other retailers are doing and cut out sharp practices. But I just feel from the top, we need a slightly more pro-business voiced and a as well, and they need to be slightly less risk averse and stop thinking only about, what's in it for me, what's in it for my shareholders, what's in it for my company if I speak a little bit more openly. They've got to back themselves to the say, and they've got to back the private sector. These are hugely important ambassadors, these people, the men and women who lead our public companies. And that's why I think it's partly beholden on them to try and push the private sector, business, free enterprise, as a noble ambition and something more importantly that's crucial of the success of the country.
And with hospitality, which you mentioned there, and retail, likewise with house builders, I think in London at the moment are coming under a bit of flak. You might have seen the Greens and the boroughs that they have control over are starting to take a bit of a shot at house builders not delivering enough affordable housing. When it comes to issues like viability, which isn't a particularly interesting issue for anyone outside of the bubble to listen to or talk about, similarly with challenges around hospitality and retail and then now with house building, what would your message be to how to tell that message in a way that isn't just about bean counting and numbers, but is telling that message in a way that resonates with a wider audience and that achieves some sort of cut through?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think hospitality have actually been quite successful in that because everyone can relate to a restaurant, everyone can relate to a pub. They have a warm, fuzzy feeling about hospitality generally, except maybe when the price of a pint goes up £1, they can't eat out in a pizza joint for less than £100. People get upset about that, but I think generally hospitality is an industry that has been able to get across its deep frustration of what it feels as being a series of lows that have made it harder and harder for the sector to thrive. We know that a lot of hubs are going out of business, and restaurants are struggling, and they have shouted it loud. And I, in a way, I think they can talk in a language that people can understand, and as a result, they did get this 20% rebate on business rates from Andy Burnham was one of his, as one of his first decisions. And everyone goes to a restaurant, everyone goes to a pub, everyone goes to the high street, and people are really worried about the state of their high streets. It's very high up people's everyday concerns and quite a big influence on how they vote. House building is a trickier one. I do wish the sector could find a better word than viability, because it is a bit of a turn-off, and basically it means, does it make sense? Can we afford to build this property? And I think they could maybe come up with a better word for that. And I do think the house building sector is one that's guilty of sometimes absolutely burying itself in jargon of ratios and financial words that people can't relate to. And also I think people feel maybe there was a time when the house building sector was making huge amounts of profit. the chief executive, the boards were making unbelievable amounts of money and so on. I think there's a slightly less sympathetic attitude towards the house building sector. But nevertheless, you know, it's another essential sector, and without the house building sector and the public sector and the governments and local authorities all working together, we're never going to get the homes that we need in this country. So really important that the house building sector gets its message across in a way that suggests that it's got the general public on its side. I think there are some companies that do it better than others, but some come across as just sort of profit-making machines, and sometimes the quality of the homes also doesn't appear to be what people require.
Yeah. So house builders, you think, could look to other sectors such as hospitality for lessons learned about how to cut through and build a narrative arc that has some personal or emotive threads throughout? Is that?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, although it's a totally different spending decision to a pint that you might have two or three times a week or more often or less often, obviously you only buy a house once every 5, 10, 15, 20 years. It's a different decision, but it's an intensely personal decision, obviously, and has a huge impact on your life. And I think house builders should reach out a little bit more maybe to address that sort of aspiration of the people who are their end consumers.
Yeah. And just to move on a little bit, so a number of our clients and companies we work with are developers and investors, particularly with, you know, they've got schemes of all shapes, all sizes, their own set of local and political challenges. Should, and this is a bit of a loaded question, should they be afraid of the media and or media interest, and how should they factor in engagement, do you think, into what their plans are?
Yeah. It's a tough one, isn't it? Because, you know, we need developers, we need the what the developers bring, regeneration, housing, retail, office space, we need all of that. But developers, they're a bit like kind of landlords, and there are certain categories of sort of characters in society that are always cast as being the baddies, or nearly always. And developers are definitely in that space. And there's hardly a major development in London I can think of that hasn't upset some group of people, whether it's, damaging a historic view or damaging or taking someone's light or taking, overshadowing a historic building, or, you know, there's almost always a negative, and a group of campaigners who start organize themselves to oppose that development. And I think developers find it very hard to get on the right side of that argument, and I think that it's very frustrating. But I think they just need to recognize and sort of understand that in the newspaper world, a group of ordinary people who appear to have been hard done by versus the developer, that group of ordinary people is always going to be the voice that's heard first. That's always going to be the headline. Okay, the developer gets their quotes at the end. And I know a lot of developers are hugely frustrated by that. They think they've got a good story to tell, but they find it very hard to get that in the headline, get that in the top half of the story. You know, their quote, as I say, is relegated to the bottom of the story, and it's very, very frustrating for them. But, you know, I think they just have to, again, have confidence in their own scheme, understand that, you know, I sometimes hear developers rather dismissing local opposition to a proposal is, oh, we always get a bit of that, we always get a bit of noise, you know, that you'd expect that. And I think they need to sometimes be a little bit more accommodating and understanding of why people feel upset or hacked off about a particular proposal, particularly if it's a really, really, really big scheme. as a lot of them are in London and Central.
I think it's, yeah. I think sometimes with the situations like that, when you get local opposition, is there's always a discussion around that's a communications challenge or a media challenge. But actually, a lot of the time, it's an engagement challenge. So have local people actually been listened to? And yes, there is a component sometimes where the scheme just has to proceed or criticism isn't warranted at all. But there is an element there of, you know, what is the engagement right? How has feedback been reflected or not reflected, and how is it being played back through to the community? That plays out through comms and media, but I don't think fundamentally it's a comms problem, which I think often gets misplaced. Where have you seen, so you said before about it's important the developers to get on the front foot if they want to counter that. How do you think they do that? And then if a scheme goes off the rails, where have you seen companies handle that well, and then you've seen companies handle that not so well? How do they make a difference there?
It's a good question. I'll give you an example from a few years ago where the way we reported two different schemes at Leaving Standard was completely different. Two contemporaneous schemes. One was Battersea Power Station. And one was Earlscourt, which were two schemes, two major developments were going on at the same time. Battersea Power Station got a lot of positive coverage. For one thing, the developers were taking a much-loved London building, the power station, which had been derelict for 30 years, and were rejuvenating it, investing very heavily in it, restoring it to give it some use, a new lease of life, new purpose. And they were investing, hundreds and hundreds of millions of doing that. I think, Londoners were very excited. We were very excited that this study. At the same time, another company, Capco, Cash and Counties, were taking another London landmark, which was the Earlscourt Exhibition Centre, the scene of many famous concerts and so on, which many Londoners have gone to and have happy memories of. And they were going to build a development, not totally similar to the Battersea Power Station development, driven by housing, but a lot of, fire market housing, and could also mix big mixed-use schemes. But they were going to knock it down. They were knocking down Earlscourt. So immediately, that was a different story. The story was developer knocks down, demolishes much-loved London landmark. Battersea Power Station was developer rebuilds and restores much-loved London landmark. And they got totally different coverage of the result. And I know for our Capco bosses were tearing their hair out. They couldn't understand why we were being so horrible about their scheme. It was the Battersea Power Station scheme. It was on front page and written up in glowing terms. So that was a really good example of two different, not dissimilar, projects that got completely different coverage in the Standard. So I think you have to think about what you're giving back. Obviously they do, they can't about those 106 contributions and all the rest of it, but can you sell this development? Is it something that Londoners are going to appreciate for decades, maybe centuries to come, or is it just another box that's going to, obviously bring some much-needed office space or whatever, but also might annoy people because it's taking light, it's too high, it's whatever. But I think you have to think very hard, what are you bringing? What are you bringing to the community? What are you putting back? So there's that. I think the engagement piece is also very important, and something it has to feel that it's not just going through the motions. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it comes over as purely box ticking, going through the motions. All the consultations have called on conclusion, and that annoys people as well, upsets people. I think there has to be an element in which developers say, we are listening and we will change our plans if local people are not happy with what we're proposing.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And with the way that media report schemes as well, I think it's also, even if there isn't anything particularly interesting to say, it's always worth, I think, getting on the front foot and saying what you have to say or what the benefits are, because, you know, ultimately journalists and people that read papers or media online, you know, they're not mind readers. They need to absorb what the key messages are or what the scheme actually is aiming to deliver all the benefits. And sometimes I think staying silent just means that vacuum gets filled elsewhere. And ultimately, you've got to communicate, exactly. Just quickly, because I know we're running out of time a little bit. You mentioned Andy Burnham earlier on in this podcast. His focus is obviously a monumental shift, I think, in the UK at the moment, which is a pulling of the political centre up to the north of England. I'm really interested to know what your take is, being a former London-based and focused journalist, with the media being a London, you know, physically London-located industry generally. How do you think this is going to affect journalism in the UK? And what do you think that this might mean for how investment stories get told in the UK?
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, you know, I love London. I've reported about London for 30 years. The greatest city in the world. And, you know, I live there, raise my children there. I adore London. But I do also recognize that this country, where the UK has a problem, that probably, I think Andy Burnham is right, for the last 45 years or so, that there's been a hollowing out of many of the regions of the UK. And that's kind of reflected in a small way, even in the way British newspapers structure themselves. Because when I started on Fleet Street, most of the major newspapers would have a northern correspondent, a southwestern correspondent, a stringer in the East Anglia, a stringer in the, you know, a northeast correspondent, someone in Wales. And often they were, you know, full-time staff journalists. Gradually that national coverage has been wound down for all sorts of reasons, a lot of it to do with cost. And I think, you know, coverage of the regions has diminished as a result. It'd be interesting to see now if that starts to pivot back the other way. I suspect we will start definitely seeing more Manchester correspondents or North of England correspondents coming back on the major newspapers, because clearly there's a very, very strong ambition to take some of that enormous power, wealth and influence from London and distribute it around the country, and entirely rightly so. You know, we do, as a country, we desperately need the regions to have to be firing on all cylinders as well as London. So it's going to be interesting to see whether it really does make a difference, or whether it's, you know, like many attempts in the past, it turns out to be a bit of a gimmick and, you know, it doesn't make any real change to the economics of the country outside London. I hope it does, because I think it's... Britain is a much healthier, better place if the regions are doing well and, you know, firing on all cylinders, as I say, and making their own economic contribution to the overall national economy. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is important. I think it's important that, even on a very symbolic level, that we've got a prime minister with an obvious northern accent, who comes from an obvious northern background. We've had a succession of prime ministers who sound like they come from London and the South East, and it's time, you know, it's time for something different. So, interesting.
Yeah. And do you have any indications or any thoughts on how you think the media might respond to this seismic shift?
Well, as I say, I think, you know, 90% of national newspaper journalists are based in London, so I think they will. I don't know if that's a figure I've cut from the air, by the way, but I suspect it's probably not too far from the reality. I think we will see some attempt, or at least some thought given to whether newspapers need to put some more resource into the regions, particularly maybe the north of England, where it all seems to be happening at the moment. But we've not heard of anything particularly happening yet, but it's early days. But I think we could well see a little mini Fleet Street developing in Manchester.
Maybe something to watch out for. Finally, just before we let you go, Jonathan, you're moving into a new role shortly in the Telegraph's business team as retail editor, covering for Hannah Boland while she's on maternity leave. Can you give us an indication about what you're most looking forward to, what your focus areas are likely to be, and, you know, how does retail change how you're going to look at issues such as the built environment, such as high streets, repurposing space, retail-led regeneration? What are you thinking? I know you're not in the role just yet, but what are you thinking you're likely to focus on in your new role?
Well, I think I'm very excited about it. Really looking forward to it. It'd be interesting. I've written about from a national perspective since I was at the Times quite a few years ago for the Standard, so that's going to be interesting. I think
maybe you'll have a spot up in Fleet Street North, Charleston.
Yeah, maybe I'm going to end up in Manchester. That's it. I think the health of the high street around the country is an enormous issue. Wither the high street? Is it going to continue as the main sort of retail, physical retail space that we visit, or are high streets going to be completely repurposed and changed? You know, maybe more residential development coming to high streets, more leisure. But the bigger question is, how do we make high streets healthy so that when we walk down the high street, we don't feel depressed? And people are very attached to their local town centres and high streets, so I think that's going to be an absolutely massive issue. I think there'll still be a focus on London. The West End is an absolutely global retail centre, you know, it's globally renowned. So I think things that happen on in the West End, on Oxford Street, on Regent Street, Bond Street, I think they're still going to be of interest to our national readership, I hope. And also, obviously, our biggest retailers, the retail names that everyone knows and loves, M&S, John Lewis, Next, Tesco, Sainsbury's, obviously be having a huge focus on them as well. So, yeah, it'd be a mix, but obviously much more focus on those little high streets up and down the land outside London.
Fascinating. Be very interesting to see how you get on there, and look forward to working with you a lot more in your new role, Jonathan. So all the best, and I'm sure we'll be in touch on several other potential stories soon. Yes, thank you so much, Jonathan. That's all we've got time for today, but just want to say thank you so much for coming on the podcast this morning. And yeah, all the best in your new role at the Telegraph. We look forward to seeing your name pop up in the news feeds a lot more shortly. So thanks, and see you next time.